Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Four decades ago, in the tiny rural Illinois town of Macon, where the water tower was the highest building around and some homes still lacked electricity, an unlikely collection of farm boys made a legendary run to the state high school title game. For many, the trip to Peoria marked their first visit to a hotel. At the time, high school baseball teams weren't split into classifications in Illinois, so schools like Macon rarely reached the tournament. Enrollment was low, and the team was stocked with underclassmen. Their uniforms were tattered and mismatched. When a bat broke, it got taped back up. But the Ironmen were no regular team. Led by unconventional English teacher Lynn Sweet, a hippie dreamer who had few rules in the classroom and was even looser on the field, Macon's players grew closer than brothers, overcoming the odds and making Sweet, a one-time outsider considered too progressive for a town like Macon, a statewide celebrity. Sports Illustrated senior writer Chris Ballard tells the story of the Ironmen in his exceptional new book, One Shot at Forever, A Small Town, An Unlikely Coach, and a Magical Baseball Season, which is published by Hyperion. Chris Ballard, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
Was Lynn Sweet's coaching by design, or was that just the way he was?
I think he figured it out as he went. You know, he'd played a little bit of semi-pro baseball when he was younger, but it was a kind of semi-pro baseball where if you had a good game, you know, they gave you some beer at the tavern afterwards. And so when they needed a new baseball coach at Macon, you know, the previous two baseball coaches had quit on the team and just didn't want to deal with it because it was the fourth sport on the rung there at Macon High. They sort of asked around at school. And, you know, Lynn was just an English teacher at the time. He'd never done any coaching. But with a little coercing from the parents of the players, they brought him on. And I think his initial decision was, well, you know, I'm going to take the same strategies I've used in the classroom. I mean, I'm going to empower kids. I'm going to make them think, a little Socratic method, and see how it applies to baseball. And then, you know, adding that into his natural skill, which, you know, I think helped him. He was able to throw batting practice and get out there and play with the kids and become part of the team. It started to evolve as it went on. I think he realized, wow, the kids are really responding to this because they've been accustomed to this Vince Lombardi-era style of coaching where coaches just yelled at them, and it was a disciplinary thing, and you did what the coaches said, and then they drilled it into enough times that it became innate. That was the whole goal. And Sweet wanted these kids to think. So he'd say, you know, instead of me telling you when to steal a base, why don't you guys signal to me when you're on the base pass if you think you should run? And if I disagree, I'll wave you off. Otherwise, go for it.
And it's interesting to note that he had rebelled against his father in many ways, who was a very strict, a military man. And then those were the same kinds of people he was coaching against all throughout this run.
Yeah, it's certainly a theme for him, you know, coming down from Chicago to Macon at the time, which was, you know, as I write in the book, was firmly stuck still in the Eisenhower era in the late 60s. And then the further that team went in the playoffs, the more coaches of that ilk they'd run up against. A lot of them just didn't like the way that Sweet conducted himself for the team. You know, he started growing his hair out. He had a Fu Manchu. The players had peace signs on their hats. They ran out to the field playing Jesus Christ Superstar on an 8-track tape. And this just rubbed people the wrong way, but Sweet delighted in it. He loved this idea of going up against the existing order and tweaking it a little bit. I think he found real joy in it.
So the first season Lynn coached, the team was a ragtag collection with some talented kids. It went farther than expected, and Lynn found himself fired, basically, as the baseball coach going into the season. How did that happen?
You know, that's one of the interesting things in reporting this book. There was a lot of mystery around this. It was a story told by a lot of people that this roster had been turned in or it hadn't been turned in prior to the regional game against Stewart's at Strasburg. And the player who had been added to the roster was a track and field substitute coming in, and he had the game-winning hit, or the hit that led to the game-winning rally. So when they get to the next level and it turns out that, well, either they did or didn't turn in this roster and get self-reported, there's some backlash and the team got disqualified, which for a town this small and this group of guys was heartbreaking because they never had a chance to go this far in a baseball tournament before, and they didn't even lose. They just got disqualified for this. So Sweet was pretty angry. The players were pretty angry, and I think there was some backlash from that, and there were discussion about whether the principal, Bill McCullard, had been the one to engineer this. He'd long disliked Sweet. He'd threatened to fire him before as a teacher, and here was an opportunity to cut him down from below. And so Sweet to this day thinks that's probably what happened, is McCullard decided whether or not he had that roster to self-report it. And then afterwards, you know, that next fall, McCullard is successful in firing Sweet as the baseball coach. And this is, you know, off a season in which the team had its best year ever in the history of Macon. So a lot of people were upset about that as well.
Long story short, he ends up getting the job back just before the season, goes on to coach the team with some returning talent, including the kid they called Shark, who was this hyper-intense pitcher and their leading hitter. They make another run into the playoffs, and it starts to become a statewide story when people finally see what this team looks like. I mean, Bad News Bears isn't too much off the mark, at least from looks, not talent-wise. How exactly were they able to compete with schools, you know, 50 times bigger?
I think these guys just didn't know better. That's one of the things they talk about today. Macon is 1,200 people, and Elwin, the other town in the district, was 80. To go up to Decatur, which is only, you know, 10 miles north of there, that was a big trip. Some of these guys had never even been to Decatur. So the idea of a team from Chicago was a fantastical thing. You know, they couldn't even imagine what it was like. Had they known exactly where they're up against, it might have been different. You know, Lane Tech had 5,200 kids, all boys. They had over 400 kids come out for baseball just as freshmen every year. They've been to all these state championships. They were a dominant team that produced major league players regularly. And this is one of the teams that Macon played. And one of the things Sweet did was he kept them in the dark. He purposefully kept them at the tournament away from these other teams. He didn't want them to be intimidated. He wanted them to play free and easy. And, you know, you can't overlook the fact they did have a fair amount of talent. You know, two of their players ended up being drafted into the minor leagues with the Atlanta Braves and St. Louis Cardinals, and they've been playing together a long time. But it was one of those situations where they just kept believing and no one told them they couldn't do it.
Some of the players, and what makes the book, I think, is that you have caught up with them nowadays and followed their stories. Some of them have been able to let it go and moved on with their lives. Snitker, one of the stars, rose all the way to the Atlanta Braves as a coach. Others have not had such an easy time letting go of that moment. What did it mean for these guys?
Yeah, that's what really drew me to it in the first place. A lot of people have asked me, had it turned out differently, would you still want to write this book? And the answer is no, because what I find fascinating is the way these high school memories have resonated. And so for someone like Dale Otte, who was the shortstop, and Dean Otte, his brother, his twin brother, who was the catcher, this is really one of the defining moments of their life. They had hats and T-shirts made when the book came out. They were being asked for their autograph. This was just a tremendous moment during their youth that they have lived on and lived for, you know, for these intervening 40 years. And then Steve Schartzer, who you mentioned earlier, you know, he's been haunted by this for 40 years, and it's taken a long time for him to try to come to terms with it, because he felt like this wasn't just about Steve Schartzer or just about the Macon Ironmen, that he was representing the town of Macon, and then later that he was representing all small towns everywhere.
Schartzer is just a fascinating figure here, because early, you know, when they're in high school, he's the most intense player, doesn't take losses well, but really the team leader. And when the team ultimately falls in the title game, it's still viewed by the townspeople as one of the most monumental moments in the history of Macon, if not the most important moment for the town. And it was a victory. Yeah, they lost and they finished in second place, but everyone was ready to celebrate it. Schartzer is still sitting on the bus, and fast forward 40 years, he still doesn't want to show his face in Macon.
They drive back from that championship game, and the school has held graduation for them that night until 11 p.m. There's, you know, multiple mile fire trucks and cars trailing them into town, a parade waiting for them. This is how jubilant the town is, and as you said, Schartzer just can't get past it. And when I first approached him 2.5 years ago about writing a story for Sports Illustrated, it's only because his daughter asked him to do it that he spoke to me. He'd only been back to Macon for funerals in the intervening time. He lives in Alabama now. And then when I decided to turn this into a book, I approached him again. And once again, it took him a while to decide, and really only when he asked Lynn Sweet, and Sweet said, you know, do it, Shark. And even then, he said, you know, I can't figure out what this is. And it was actually a very touching moment. I went back to Decatur for a book event a week and a half ago. And the Decatur Public Library hosts this event. More than 350 people show up. They run out of room. And the lady cuts up there to introduce me, and she says, the librarian, she says, you know, did you guys leave anyone in Macon tonight? And it really was, this entire community comes out. All the players are up on, right up next to me on the, near the podium. And Schartzer, on a whim, decided midway through that week to fly up from Alabama. And he shows up about 10 minutes into this presentation, and he gets a standing ovation from 400 people. It was a tremendous moment. Then he gets up there and makes a speech, and he has people crying, he has people laughing, and he ends with, all I want to say is, I'm sorry. And he gets a second standing ovation. This is a high school athlete from 40 years ago getting standing ovations from these people. And I think afterwards he did feel a little bit of closure.
Well, that's good. That's good to hear. Let me ask about his partner in all of this, Coach Sweet, who was so young when he began. Took a team from nowhere to the state title game and could have, if you wanted, built a program, you know, in his image for the next 30 years if he wanted to be one of those powerhouse baseball coaches. He didn't want it. He walked away a couple years later. How come he didn't want to stay in this role as a baseball coach?
He felt like the fun had been drained from it. Early on, 1970 and 71, they have the hand-me-down uniforms, you know, Jesus Christ Superstar, they're just sort of out there playing. And then after they make it to that state final game, there's expectations, there's new uniforms. Parents are expecting them to go back and do it. Parents are getting on them about the kids. And he goes on to win, I believe it's 48 consecutive conference games. Very successful. They don't make it back to that state final again. And then one day he decides he's had enough, that this isn't why he got into it, that sports isn't about making it into a job. Sports is about fun and growth and learning. And so he goes on, he keeps teaching English, and he ends up becoming a coach for girls cross country, and he can find that joy there again. But he just felt like the game had become more than a game in a bad way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it changed his reputation around town also. Did Macon catch up to him, or was it just the success on the field that made Sweet all of a sudden so palatable to the powers that be in Macon?
It was that interesting time, you know, 1971, and it was really hard to deny the cultural shifts, even in a place like Macon. So I think, A, that was happening. B, everyone saw, this guy's really having a positive effect on our kids. We might not like the way he's doing it, but all the kids loved him as an English teacher. They're going on and going to college interested in writing and reading, and some of them are pursuing careers in that. On the baseball field, he was having a lot of success. So they couldn't deny that he was being successful. They didn't like how he was doing it, but they had to eventually decide, you know what, maybe this guy's on to something.
Where do you think the Macon story goes from here? You've solidified it now in this great book, gotten a lot of the guys back together. What do they see as the future of this group?
Well, you know, this high school no longer exists. It got consolidated into Meridian High, to neighbor towns, so there's no more Macon High. I think this is going to be the final great memory of Macon High that will live on for these guys, perhaps for the town, and then there'll be a new set of kids making new memories at Meridian. But hopefully what happens is, from just seeing it, you know, a week and a half ago, this brings together a community that had really sort of dispersed a bit and gives them a sense of, okay, this did matter and it still matters.
We've been speaking with Sports Illustrated senior writer Chris Ballard. He's the author of One Shot at Forever, A Small Town, An Unlikely Coach, and A Magical Baseball Season, which is published by Hyperion. Hey, Chris, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.